Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. He's Leighton Kling. A little bit about today's show. It's going to be a little bit different than what you're used to. A little bit behind how the sausage is made as far as our show is concerned. Typically, we put together a rundown during the course of the week. We go back and forth on what items we're including, what to talk about, how to talk about each item. We just got tired of having to rewrite the rundown so many times because the news is changing so much. And if we were to talk about any type of current events on this, any type of retail news on this podcast, it would be outdated by the time everyone out there listens to it, which might even be just a few hours after we're recording. So what we're doing instead is we're creating a little bit more of a generalized podcast. We're going to talk about our early impressions. Leighton also did some business-related traveling. He's going to talk about what he saw during the course of that time as well. A reminder to like us and rate us. However you do access us, whether that be on Spotify, whether that be on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast delivery service, you can also check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast. So we'll start out with this. As I mentioned, Leighton, you did a lot of business travel during the course of the last week. You visited, I believe, three different states, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Arkansas. What were some of the things you saw there? Not only COVID-19 related, but other retail trends you saw in those areas?
Yeah, a lot to unpack during my most recent travels. Like you said, on business, kind of traveling around that entire area, went to Arkansas, like you had mentioned, Tennessee. A lot of traveling in Tennessee, I probably put close to 3,000 or 4,000 miles on the automobile that I was running. So in just a short period of time, you see that a lot of retailers are reacting in different ways to this COVID-19 outbreak. And you see that a lot of retailers are handling it in stride in terms of their media coverage, but overall, a sight to behold. I was in various areas, Memphis being one, and then also Nashville, which I was highly impressed with that city. That city has grown in population by about 10% over the last 10 years. A very impressive city because you have a multitude of buildings that were built in the 1910s, 1920s, that have been redone, refurbished, had a lot of capital put back into them. And they exist really in the midst of a lot of new development, new construction, a lot of new apartment buildings downtown, a lot of new commercial buildings that are holding both retail and office space. So a lot of different things going on downtown. But Trent, the highlights for me, I really wanted to see what retailers overall that maybe people on this podcast would recognize because they're retailers that we talk about with earnings reports, how they are doing right now over the past 48 hours or so. And this is interesting because it brings up a lot of future questions. But for right now, I'm seeing that there's still traffic at Home Depot and Lowe's. So a lot of those retailers have just differentiated hours during this time. So they're trying to minimize a lot of that social proximity that they're talking about, but they'll still have traffic coming into the stores. And I think that's something that not a lot of retail analysts are thinking about right now because everyone's fixated on paper goods and grocery as far as those hot takes we see on Twitter and Instagram. But the reality is a lot of people are kind of bored at home, and those who cannot work remote that do have discretionary income, I think, are choosing to go into that local Lowe's or even if it's an Ace Hardware, if some of those franchise locations turned out to be still open over the weekend, how many people are going in and actually finally getting to that project that they wanted? I mean, they have to stay inside anyway, so it really makes you scratch your head. What exactly are those customers buying, those customers that are making the trip outside of the home and to go into their local Home Depot or Lowe's? Again, we've talked about this before on the podcast, but these kinds of retailers that I'm about to mention are pretty much resistant to anything, and that is CVS and Walgreens. Both retailers I witnessed firsthand staying open for normal business hours. I don't know if that applies for every single state and every single location, but CVS and Walgreens had very adequate traffic levels. And you speak to some of the store personnel, they said it's actually not that low and it's not that high in terms of the daily revenue that they've been getting over the past several days. I go with that to grocery. And one of the big reasons is if a local grocery store is closed, you can bet that that customer is going to that local Rite Aid or CVS or Walgreens to make that purchase, whatever they were going to buy inside that grocery store. But from what I saw, most municipalities, and this is for Memphis and Nashville as well, They kept all of their grocery stores open. Maybe their abbreviated hours, but maybe just by 1 or 2 hours. The local Whole Foods closed just 1 hour early. So you see a lot of people still looking through those shelves, looking to see if there's anything else they think they need over the next 3 to 4 weeks. And I think that's highly important, Trent, because we talk about empty shelves with this outbreak and how people bought certain goods that they feel like they absolutely needed if they needed to stay inside closed doors for the next 1 to 2 months. And you have to wonder, is that going to trigger a supply chain problem wherein maybe store management or district management or even at the corporate level, they're saying that, oh no, people are still going to be coming in wanting those same items in that same manner, in that very, very rare case where you have a lot of items sold out that normally do not sell that fast? Are they going to continue that momentum and issue sort of guidance to their supply chain that could be off? So it's going to be a matter of liquidity, and it's going to be a matter of smart thinking, because not all the time you can look back at historical sales during something like this and bank on a particular strategy to move forward in a more seamless, integrated way. I think it's going to be a struggle for a lot of grocers to figure out, okay, if we stay open, what exactly do we need going forward? Because they too are trying to limit their cash and trying to really allocate capital in an appropriate way in this potential downturn over the next 6 months or so. Wholesale is good, and we talk about such a robust industry as of late, Trent. It was just last month we talked about Costco and how they really didn't give updated guidance, but they didn't seem that pessimistic about the future, and they saw a lot of customers coming in, and they continue to come in. However, I will note, coming back to Southern California after my very, very short two-day trip, I did notice that they are limiting customers in some locations like they are in some grocery stores. So for instance, you can only have X amount of people at a time, let's say 25 or 50 in the store making those purchases at a time. They'll literally have security guards at an exit door counting the number of people leaving, which would then enable that exact number to go back in on the entrance side of the equation. So a lot of interesting things happening there. But this is a recent thing that I've noticed just in the past couple of days, Trent, or at least been hearing as well, where you'll have lines outside of Costco. The store is open, but they can only release a certain amount of members inside that club at a time. So I'm curious as to how that's going to affect sales and the expectation from those customers. Look, it says you're open. Why can't I just go in the store and get what I need? Instead, they're waiting in lines outside the store. It may be a little frustrating. Lastly, and I'll leave on this, Trent, I had a few more points, but I don't want to take up the entire podcast. You look at dollar stores, and in particular, the dollar stores that have evolved over the last 5 to 10 years to have a bigger stake in grocery in terms of the market share with the freezer and cooler items. You have Dollar Tree implementing coolers and freezers. You have Family Dollar, which is obviously the wholly owned subsidiary of Dollar Tree, doing the same exact thing. And as a result, their traffic is also fairly solid because they carry a broader grocery selection. And those grocery stores, municipalities are really, really tepid in terms of trying to shut those down. They want people to at least have that fundamental security of being able to have a local store providing, at the very least, groceries and paper goods. And those are really, really big items right now when I go and talk or interview people one-on-one about what they're buying inside those stores. But so you're going to see that whole bundle there in that dollar store equation. We're talking Family Dollar, Dollar Tree, of course, which I just mentioned. But then also, you have their most major competitor inside the United States with trying to open 1,000 stores in fiscal 2020. Dollar General absolutely killing it. Again, same thing with grocery stores. You may see a tiny bit of abbreviated hours, but we're just talking 1 to 2 hours early because they're still seeing solid traffic levels. And they really do, whether it's true for revenue or not, they really do want to serve their customer base in a time of need. 99 Cent Store down here in Southern California where I live, also doing very well. Having a produce selection, which oftentimes dollar stores do not have, so very convenient for their remaining fresh items. And Trent, with that, I'll hand it off to you. I will say it was a very good trip. I learned a lot. And every single time I go out, I just have to think about the podcast and what is happening with brick and mortar retail on the front lines of something this massive, something that has overtaken social media. This is all we see on our Twitter account, which, by the way, I did tweet a few photos of some malls I visited when I was out there, and also the whole body concept from Whole Foods when I was visiting a location there in Nashville, Tennessee.
You know, a couple of things that you mentioned that I wanted to touch on. First, of course, the traffic at Home Depot and Lowe's. Now, I should mention, for the most part, I am practicing what you would call, you know, social distancing or self-isolation or whatever you want to call it, whatever the buzzword is that's popular there. But I did manage to get out, drive a little bit. I haven't been to retailers nearly as much as I thought I would, certainly this week. But Home Depot, Lowe's, both very busy. But going to the Home Depot and Lowe's websites, Home Depot, I think, doing a slightly better job of advertising their buy online, pick up in store mechanisms, some of their delivery mechanisms as well. So I think all of that is a positive. One other thing that you mentioned that I wanted to touch on is in terms of the supply chain. I was talking to actually someone that works as a merchandiser in grocery stores, and they're one of those that travels from grocery stores to convenience stores, that type of thing, merchandises their given products. And they said that actually the business has been fairly steady for them as well. You think about those merchandisers for companies like Frito-Lay, companies like dairies and bakeries, those third-party merchandisers, they are also assisting those stores with the supply chain mechanisms. It'll be interesting to see if those distributors actually beef up their merchandising teams because of this as well. Now, as far as you mentioning dollar stores, you know, Dollar Tree, Dollar General, 99 cent store, Family Dollar, you wonder if some of those store caps that you were talking about, those caps with Costco and Target and those grocers in Southern California where you can only have X amount of people at a time in those stores, you wonder if that's kind of pushing people to alternative locations to shop to pick up their wares. And there are a lot of people, I feel like, that don't typically shop at dollar stores that are kind of moving over into that particular area to do their shopping, especially when it comes to paper goods, which, as we know, have been so difficult to find in stores. We'll have an interview with Carly Kaler, by the way, and Carly is a performance content writer at VMLYNR. Carly will talk a little bit about writing product descriptions for online retailers, and never has that been so important as what we've seen this last couple of weeks with more and more people shopping online. I think some other longer-term questions exist. How much will this push people permanently to shopping online or in a buy online pickup in store fashion? How much will it expose people to those elements of retail that maybe they didn't know existed or hadn't tried until this week? Those are some interesting things, and it would be a difficult time to be a brick and mortar retailer that does not have an online presence if you're not a dollar store that's out there. So one other thing that we wanted to do here is kind of ascribe at least early winners and losers to all of this. And you can say, well, guys, you know, hey, it's a pandemic. There are no winners here, whatever. But we're a retail podcast. It is kind of our duty as a podcast to say, hey, these retailers are the ones that are either doing well in the face of adversity or seeing a lot of success in terms of that traffic coming in for whatever reason. Meanwhile, there are retailers that are struggling, and some retailers might not make it out of this. So I'll go ahead and start. You know, one certainly sector that is an obvious winner here is grocery stores. But I want to look beyond the bottom line and the top line, of course, for these grocery stores and look at what the stores are doing beyond this. Kroger just this last week announced bonuses for their employees working during this month. It's going to be $300 for full-time employees, $150 for part-time employees. That's pretty good. They're bolstering up some of their paid sick leave for those that feel like they might have coronavirus, which the AP style guide says we should refer to coronavirus as the new coronavirus or the novel coronavirus, and then refer to COVID-19 as the illness that coronavirus causes. But in any case, you know, the terms in theory can't be used one substituting for the other. So we'll just call it coronavirus here in this circumstance. But in this case, you look at Kroger, they've certainly beefed up their staff, but I've been most impressed with Albertsons and Safeway and all of those brands under that banner during this process. Not only are they going through stores today, they've been doing it all day long. Tomorrow, they're going to continue doing it. They're putting up sneeze guards. They're putting up plexiglass to separate the cashiers from the actual customers. But they also, instead of just giving a one-time bonus, at least for now, they have gone through and they have raised everyone's wages across the board by $2 an hour. And that's for both union and non-union employees. that's stellar, because, and it might result in a larger gain to those employees than just the one-time bonus, but I think it really speaks to the fact that they're looking to take care of those employees. I think the sneeze guards are something that you might see them actually linger in place for a lengthy amount of time, but they've also been one of the stores that has been better in terms of managing their supply chain. I know here in Colorado, they are hiring 1,000 employees just as a part-time or a temporary basis to help stock their stores, to help assist their supply chain as well. So you look, 1,000 jobs that are opening up, and we'll get to Walmart in a little bit. They've announced actually more temporary jobs that they are hiring for, more seasonal jobs, if you will, or more coronavirus-related jobs. But certainly those two firms, Albertsons and Kroger, really doing well in terms of attempting to make sure their employees are taken care of. But I think Albertson certainly comes out of this looking decent from the PR front, because they've fought so hard to keep things in stock. They've got great relationships with their suppliers and with the major brands. And I think that's certainly something that you're going to look at as they, just earlier this month, and by the way, all the coronavirus COVID-19 stuff kind of covered this up, but earlier this month, they submitted preliminary paperwork once again with the idea of going public. So maybe a really good time for Albertsons to look good on all of these fronts and also take care of those employees. Now, Leighton, I know when you were in Tennessee, when you were in Arkansas, you visited a number of different shopping centers, and in one certainly segment of retail that you noticed was hurting. Again, another no-brainer, but every clothing retailer out there.
Yeah, Trent, that's right. A lot of clothing retailers are suffering during this period. And if you look, Trent, not just the big boys, department stores, we think of JCPenney, which is already really in a bad situation with a ton of debt on the balance sheet. Obviously, Sears, what few stores they have left. But a number of retailers that sell clothing, you think of REI and other specialty retailers, that are going to be struggling, especially think of the seasonality of this. A lot of clothes are out there for the season coming up in the summer, and there's going to be a lot of deals that will have been missed until maybe these stores can reopen. So retailers typically will already have new clothes on route to their stores or to distribution centers during this time as well. So with those supply chain implications, are they then going to have to sell some of that full price clothing that wasn't able to sell through for a couple of months to the TJ Maxx's, the Ross's, and the Burlington's of the world? And I think that that is, we're not going to say a winner here, but that's going to be the type of retailer within the clothing industry, the retail clothing sector, that's going to have the brightest opportunity. I think, honestly, those retailers are always trying to get a good deal, especially since, let's be honest, they've been all opening stores throughout the country at such a wicked pace over the past 3 to 4 years, especially Burlington, as I noted a few weeks ago, really eyeing a lot of Toys R Us locations that have been abandoned and opening there. Well, they need inventory to go into those stores. And so if they can really catch some good deals on inventory going forward through those retailers that have been struggling to move their full price merchandise, their name brand clothing, it's going to be really exciting to see how the end of the year fares, especially when, let's assume this all goes away fairly quickly by maybe the end of summer. Think about holiday shopping spending for a lot of those retailers that aren't going to just have buying opportunities from the supply side, from those kinds of retailers that have just normal clothes and dresses and pants and shoes. But then think about all the accessories that they also carry with inside the store, and things like perfume and home goods as well. So very curious to see what happens in those particular categories.
Now, I know one clear loser in addition to the clothing retailers are going to be those locally owned retailers. And in fact, when a lot of this stuff started going down and you started seeing some closures of the non-essential retailers, I thought of retailers like, we actually talked to one of them on this show a while back, but AMP Variety, for example, in Oklahoma, they're a one-off retailer. They only have that one location. They have a handful of employees. And if you force them to close down, they're not bringing in revenue, yet they're still paying their staff. They're still having to pay the rent. They're still having to pay utilities. And I'm going to talk about that in our last segment of the day, and that there's a lot of things that you've got to think about when you close a store. It's not just, hey, shutter the store and you move away. So a lot of sunk costs there for these retailers, and a lot of them aren't going to come out of it. I know, you know, sometimes people look at the whole, oh, well, many people are going to declare bankruptcy, and a lot of companies are going to declare bankruptcy as kind of a scare tactic or maybe clickbait articles, but it is absolutely true, and we're not seeing any support for these small businesses to the tune of what you need to see. For example, there are small business loans that exist out there that are $20,000 payable over 3 years, low to no interest. Well, that's great, but you're still out that $20,000. That doesn't change the fact that you got to pay back the $20,000 at some point in time. And everyone says, well, those might be forgivable. You might essentially turn them into grants or subsidies or whatever. But retailers don't know that when they come into it. So you're looking at not only destroying cash flow for this year, but also tying up your cash flow with each subsequent year of the loan and paying back that loan. I think personally, we can do a lot better, whether it's on a state basis, whether it's on a country basis. And I think if you're a small business looking at it, why would you ever, seeing this, start a small business? Like, we're going to have a potential 10 to 15 year decline in people starting small businesses, entrepreneurs coming out, taking that leap, especially on the retail side. And it's going to murder entrepreneurial retail, because the government can basically come in and say, oh, well, there's a pandemic, we got to shut you down. And you might say, well, what am I getting for it? Well, no insurance policy covers it unless it's the federal government shutting you down, in which case you might get it on a terrorism flyer, but it's probably not going to happen. So you're not going to get reimbursed from insurance. And then what's worse is, to add salt to the wound, they're going to come at you and say, hey, we'll give you a small business loan for low interest and this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, okay, well, they just shut us down and now we're in debt to them because they shut us down. It is insane to think that over the next 10 to 15 years, any business that has survived through this COVID scare, but also any person thinking about starting a small retail business, especially on the brick and mortar front, but also e-commerce as well, to know that you can be shut down in a moment's notice and just be shut down for, you know, people are saying 30 days, 3 months, 6 months, you don't know how long, and still trapped in those landlords' leases, still trapped paying utilities, still trying to pay your employees because you're told it's the right thing to do. No, this is going to be murder on the next 5 to 10 years in terms of retail entrepreneurship, especially on the brick and mortar front, if something isn't done about it. Now, all that being said, is a lot can be repaired by simply helping out the small businesses to the tune of maybe something not loan-based or something not interest-based. But most of the small business owners that I've talked to, they're looking at bankruptcy as a real, real possibility in 30 to 45 days, just as a mechanism getting out of their leases that they won't be able to afford if this lasts any length of time. One quick winner we wanted to mention, and Leighton already alluded to it, though, as we move on from that little, you know, small business rant there, is CVS, Walgreens, and Rite Aid front of store. People have got to come in to pick up prescriptions. Anyway, a lot of them are leveraging the drive-thru, but it's focusing more and more attention on that front of store presence that all three of those retailers have, maybe enticing people to pick up groceries, enticing them to pick up other items that they weren't able to find at one of the larger general merchandise retailers. I think a lot of focus has kind of centered back towards the front of store, and I think you're going to see some positive results from the front of store in each of those three retailers, because again, those are considered by every state so far as being crucial retailers, key retailers that need to stay open. Speaking of that, GameStop made an argument this week that they were a crucial retailer because they were selling software that allowed people to work from home, but that hasn't been the case. And after a GameStop conference call got leaked earlier this week with some maybe less than savory remarks from leadership towards individual store owners, they took it on the chin this week as far as PR is concerned. Not a good look, considering they've been struggling mightily, really, for most of the last 3 to 5 years. But now you see them basically, you know, the way it's been spun is forcing their folks to work, forcing them to take paid sick leave or sick leave if they've got it. If you're a part-time employee there, you don't have paid sick leave, we're led to believe, at least. So they kind of took it on the chin this week, PR-wise, especially once those particular details got out.
We're going to switch back to the winning side of the equation. We're going to talk about general merchandise retailers who have, in fact, curbside pickup infrastructure built in to their different store locations already. And I think this is going to be a huge one, because oftentimes right now we're talking about restaurants that have the ability to do to-go orders and not shut down completely. So they're still able to drive some revenue. And I think right now it's the same exact thing for general merchandise retailers as well. We can talk about grocery and pharmacy that are pretty much always going to be open in some capacity. But if you can be a general merchandise retailer that doesn't have to have an in-store touch point with your customer, I think that's going to be extremely helpful for those customers that want to pick up those items. Let's say they do have to go into work at their job and then come home, be able to pick that up without having to worry about that one-on-one human interaction. And I think you're going to see a lot more sales driven by other things, different categories other than those major ones as a result of that. But I think too, you are going to see, and we can look at the different graphs that are online right now with retail analytics, but you can see that certainly there are going to be a number of items that people will still prefer to maybe go to Amazon.com first. However, you are seeing that anecdotally, people are having delays with seeing some of those items come to their door within the told amount of time, within the 2 to 5 day time horizon. So it may behoove those customers to actually utilize that curbside pickup that a lot of retailers are now offering. And I think this is going to be highly important in the future, more as a learning experience. And this is really cliche, Trent. You and I listen to a ton of business podcasts, even outside the retail realm. And a lot of people will talk about, well, you don't have regrets. You can just learn from prior mistakes. And in operations within retail, I think a lot of retailers are going to look back at this and say, look, what if something similar, maybe not even as bad, but similar, happens again? What do we do to beat out our competition? And more importantly, what can we do to improve upon that customer service aspect so that customers know, listen, if there is an issue like this, if there is sort of an emergency situation, we are going to be open in some capacity. Oh, and by the way, here's how.
And we'll wrap up with a couple of ones that might be somewhere in the middle. First of all, L Brands. We talked a couple of weeks ago, the last time we had the podcast, about Bath and Body Works and how they might actually stand to benefit because of the sales of soap, because of the sales of hand sanitizer. Well, they closed most of their locations. And this is interesting because you figure that Bath and Body Works would have been classified as a necessary retailer because they're selling sanitation products and the like. So it's interesting that they chose to close most of their locations, again, under the guise of protecting their employees. But you have to think that on the business end of things too, because this is the way that for-profit businesses that are publicly traded are run, they saw some sort of financial benefit as well to closing those locations. So kind of an interesting choice there. Now, we're told that there are some Bath & Body Works locations that are still open, and one to be determined, Amazon. You know, sales are likely up at Amazon as people not wanting to leave their house because they're trying to socially distance themselves or trying to isolate themselves in their house. But at the same time, if you go to Amazon's site, a lot of key essentials are out because of, in part, lack of existing vendor relationships. You think of a business like Safeway or Walmart or Target. They had these great relationships with the likes of Procter and Gamble and so forth. Well, Amazon, their sales in those home goods areas, those essentials areas, really just a drop in the bucket when you compare them to someone like Walmart. And so when there's four companies asking for a shipment of paper towels, Walmart's probably going to win that battle over Amazon. And in fact, if you go to Amazon's site now, my spouse was just looking at Amazon's site earlier today, no paper towels will be available in stock through them or any of their vendors until May, the website says. So that's a bad thing. You know, you have a lot of people stepping towards Amazon. You had a chance to make a statement. And this is really kind of the problem when you look at those kind of Amazon Essentials lines of products. Unless you have a good supplier for those private label brands, or unless you have a great relationship with some of the name brand suppliers like the Procter and Gambles of the world, you're going to struggle in comparison to those brick and mortar stores that are still able to get product, not as much as they'd like, but still able to get some product because of their vendor relationship. Now, one final winner here is going to be those that have the opportunity to be employed by Walmart. And this just came out a few days ago. Walmart planning to hire 150,000 employees. The idea is they'll start out as temporary. They might transition into permanent employees if things hold. So for those in the service industry, those are losing their jobs. You kind of look at that and say, like, hey, that might be a benefit certainly for them and a job coming in at the right time. So we talked about Kroger hiring. We talked about Safeway and Albertsons hiring. But Walmart seems to be doing the lion's share of the hiring. Also, Amazon, of course, announced a large amount of temporary hires as well. So you look at that, and there is at least some backfilling of those jobs left vacant by restaurants, bars, and the like. Really quick, before we get to our interview this week, Leighton, I thought before the podcast, you made an excellent point because you were, of course, in an airport this week. You saw the lack of traffic, and that got you thinking about kind of the tertiary impacts from that travel.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Trent, because that was something I wanted to highlight earlier, but of course I had forgotten when I went on my own diatribe. Honestly, this is a very interesting happening because back in 2008, 2009, you saw a lot of trouble with the banks and the real estate sector because of the issues they were having that were pretty deep and systemic for a period of time. However, this is much more broad. You're talking about areas of the globe that are going to be affected by this. And as such, you have to think about not only retailers, but a lot of other areas in the service industry. So one area that I'm somewhat familiarized with is the airline industry. And by being in the airport, you can tell automatically, just any international airport right now, their traffic levels are extremely low. And what that means is a lot of airlines have chosen to take back flights. They're canceling, they're consolidating flights. If they had multiple flights to one destination, they're making sure that they're trying to be as efficient as humanly possible. But as a result of all this limited travel and the bans on international travel, you're going to see a lot less tourism, a lot more people that are afraid not only to leave the home that they're in currently, but maybe wherever they're going is also going to have maybe a more dire situation. So if you think about specialty companies, especially those, let's say, in areas that are really heavily helped out by the tourism industry. So you think of markets like in Honolulu, for instance, in Hawaii, where I had visited not that long ago. I had mentioned that there's a convenience store called ABC Stores. They're on every single corner, it seems. The majority of their locations actually are in Hawaii. They have a few in Las Vegas as well. But these convenience stores really do try to take advantage, not in a negative way, but try to take advantage of the business opportunity that exists because of the influx year-round of tourists. So a lot of the tourists come from overseas. A lot of the tourists come from the 48 states here. And so when I visited, I would notice that there's a ton of traffic for items such as alcohol and other tourism-related things, but then also groceries as well. But a lot of their store selection had to do with those guests that were strictly tourists. So t-shirts were available, games were available, that kind of thing that you would see in a store really trying to bolster sales by those coming into a new part of the country. And I think overall, you are going to see a lot of those convenience stores, even though they'll stay open and do well in terms of the food and drink that gets sold, I think they are going to hurt by that bigger picture. And Trent, one last thing that is more or less related to the overall economic condition that we're about to go through in the next several months. So a lot of people, I mentioned the service industry, that is an industry that's going to be hit the hardest. If you think about those full service restaurants that are refusing to do to-go orders and that they're cutting staff across the country, those are the types of workers that may need additional financing for their everyday needs. And so payday loan places, obviously it's not a sector we talk about in retail, but they do inhabit retail real estate. I talked to a few in my travels and they seemed to think that the traffic levels were about the same as they were prior to this COVID-19 issue. So this means that it's going to be a mix of customers not coming in because they don't want to potentially get a virus or get sick. And there's also going to be customers that are new to this type of payday loan system or payday loan type of business in order to get short-term credit to be able to make rent or to be able to put even food on the table if government assistance doesn't pan out or is not sufficient enough. So there's a ton of things to look at in terms of the micro trends that are happening within the retail and service sectors.
We go from that and a fair amount of depression, at least for whether it's a social depression or retail depression, to a somewhat uplifting interview. I think this is going to be an insightful interview that everyone out there will find interesting. We talked to Carly Kaler a few weeks ago. Again, content writer, performance content writer, that is, at VMLYR. We talked to her about writing descriptions for those online retail products that we're all seeing a lot of, since a lot of us aren't leaving the house much anytime soon. We've talked so far this podcast about retail and how hard it's being impacted by coronavirus, but if you'd like some hard data on it, Within created a dashboard to track exactly that. You can see real-time revenue trends for every major e-commerce sector. How is the conversion rate changing? Is the media spend shifting for companies in e-commerce? You can see all this and more in real time at within.co. They also have some great insights on how brands are breaking through the benchmarks and what's coming next. It's within.co to see the COVID e-commerce dashboard, to get some hard data on it. It's fascinating data. And if you run a retailer, especially an e-commerce retailer, I think you'll find it useful. That's within.co. We talked 2 weeks ago with Jeff Hunt, the founder and CEO of Snap 36, about product photography for e-commerce sales. But what about the descriptions that usually accompany that 360 imagery? Well, joining us to talk about crafting effective language for retailers and their products online is Carly Kaler, who works as a performance content writer at VMLYR. Carly, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Just to kind of start off with first, I was wondering if you could give us just an overarching view of what your day-to-day looks like in terms of producing this content.
Sure. So I'm part of a larger discoverability group that works with SEO and works with paid search and works with commerce to write content that matches what people are looking for, and then also removes friction to convert and answers the questions about the products that people want to know, and so they can help transact. So my day-to-day basically looks like, you know, starting from what products does the client have. I'll talk to SEO folks about, you know, what people are searching for. I typically work for brand websites, like not on retailer platforms. So they go to Google, find out what questions people are asking about these kinds of products. And then I just start writing, describing the specifications of the product that answers those questions, writing bullet points that are easily understood, easily scannable, and then driving to that final call to action. For the clients I work for, there are a lot of products. There are a lot of different types. It's a lot of research. I work with B2B clients describing products that I probably won't ever use in my life. But I always kind of start with that organic research to find more information about the products and find more information about the people that are looking for these products. And I guess that's kind of like where it all starts.
So I want to touch on that research a little bit more, because as you mentioned, you're not likely to use a lot of the products that you're writing for. It's just not humanly possible to do that over the course of a lifetime. But you have to get to know not only the products, but the people that are searching for the products very well. What's your process for that research like, above and beyond maybe just performing a Google search for it?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of cool tools to find out like what questions people are asking about the products. AnswerThePublic.com is a good starting point, but usually it's like, what is this? How does this work? I find that YouTube is a huge resource. Not only can you see these products in action, because a lot of like super fans are going to be filming their own like how-tos, but you can also find out like what slang terms they call these products. What do they use in the use of these products is super helpful. I also sometimes go to Reddit to see, again, like what are fans or what are consumers talking about. My organic search colleague will find like other kinds of very niche forums where they talk about how they use the product. And yeah, that is all just kind of coalescing in my brain. And then I will try to like find out common threads and commit those to the product description or the bullet point. Like, what's the most important like specification someone needs to know about this product? And then make sure that that is very visible in the content. And yeah, sometimes it's just kind of fun to see what these products do, even though I'll never really use them, but just being very curious. Even if, you know, only a small percentage of what I research goes into the content, we might use that research for the landing page or a larger like FAQ section.
So given that, that sounds like a massive undertaking in terms of research there. How many items do you make it through in a day or a week?
When I first started at VML Y&R, I was mostly doing product pages, and I would almost kind of race myself. Getting started, I could maybe do 5 to 8 a day. But then as I was getting more and more like deeper into this world, deeper into the client and into the audience, I was able to get up to about 20 per day. I've been added to different projects, and now I do bigger content pieces like landing pages, category pages. So now it's a little less. So total product pages I've written is 850.
So quite a few. There's quite a few products you've seen.
Yeah. There. Yeah. It's very interesting. The development team did this kind of scraping of the website for some reason, and they shared this like statistic with me. A year ago, the site had this many words, and now it has this many words. So you've probably added like maybe 6 figures. And you know, you've looked at product descriptions. They're not very long, but that was cool to see.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask and kind of go back to the research part of it, because you mentioned part of it is finding out what other terms, what slang terms get used. And I think we hear the term SEO thrown around a lot, but it really is kind of a fine art, because between that and making sure you don't have too many hot button words in there so you get weeded out, what's the process like in terms of trying to find that SEO sweet spot for these products?
Oh yeah, there's definitely best practices. Google is way smarter than it was a few years ago. The search algorithms can definitely tell when you're keyword stuffing. What we've had is we've had a list of like slang terms forwarded to us from the client, from people in the brick and mortar stores, and they can really like slim it down. Like, these are the slang terms that we hear the most or that we call it. And so those are obviously going to have a higher priority than, you know, everything that comes on through Google. You can see the tools that my team uses can tell you like what the search volume is. And we're going to use the ones that are used the most rather than try to target. Well, somebody calls it this 10 times a month. Like, that's not a huge volume. So that's very low priority, and we'll not use that slang term. But there isn't a magic number, but our skill is to write for people, and we don't want to, like, people can definitely tell when you're calling it, oh, this product, also known as this, like, they're just going to tune out. They aren't even going to read the product description. So making sure that it's still conversational, that it's still easy to read, and that it's not obviously just trying to rank for Google.
Now, I want to move on to the various different products you cover, because you mentioned if you've written for 850 products, you've probably seen a lot. And I'm sure the writing process for something like a product description for a drill, let's say, is different than the writing process for maybe hand lotion or something along those lines. So in terms of your approach for different products, what's your mindset going in as far as how much you're willing to change some of your language and alter things and maybe get more technical for some things like that drill and maybe a little bit more descriptive for others?
Yeah, definitely you want to start thinking about like what's the brand tone and voice. Like, if you were to look at a product page for, like you say, a drill versus a hand lotion might have a lot more romantic copy, talking about like supple, romantic, like those kinds of things. So keeping that brand tone and voice in mind, keeping the audience in mind as well. B2B audiences, for instance, for like tools for like contractors or something, they tend to really want the details and the specifications. And then for direct to consumer, for like toiletries, for those kinds of household products, you can focus also on like what it does and how it will help you and how it will solve problems. But people expect a different kind of experience when they're searching for those kinds of things, and keeping that in mind. Technical products are going to, while you still want to be conversational and still be engaging, you want to have those details, those specifications straight up. Yeah, once I'm kind of just deep in that world and deep with the research, it kind of comes easily. Once you've done so many of them, it's kind of easy to slip back into that voice and slip back into that writing process. That's where research and competitive research will also come in. What are your competitors doing? What are they offering? What kind of things do they put in their product descriptions? And that's also a good place to start. If I've been writing about tools or writing about some other kind of technical equipment, and then I have to jump onto something that's totally different, a good place to start, and this is also comes from like, you know, a Google search basically, is, well, what else is out there and how can I make this a little bit better?
So talking about language to that extent, of course, you don't have unlimited words, unlimited space. You know, people have limited attention spans there.
Yes.
So what are, maybe limit is a bad word for it, but what are the general guidelines surrounding how long things are? And do you get a little bit more leverage to go longer with certain types of products?
Yes, for the client that I work on the most, we kind of have a lot of flexibility, not too much. I would say the kind of standard best practice for a product description is between 3 to 5 sentences. You want to make sure that the page isn't stretched out with copy, that it can be read easily on mobile so that someone on their phone isn't scrolling and scrolling to get through this product description. We have a style guide that tells us like how long a product description would be, and we try not to vary so much. There are products that consumers want a lot more information about, and we try to prioritize to try to cut that down because we want it to remain consistent. We don't want a consumer who might be looking for, you know, multiple products in their order or something and have a different experience every single product page they look at, where one has like a huge paragraph and a lot of stuff to read, and then for another product we'll have 2 or 3 sentences. So we try to also keep that in mind, that we want it, the pages to look pretty consistent across the category or multiple categories.
So all that being said, and we asked this of Jeff a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about product photography, but what's the toughest single product, maybe not necessarily the brand, but toughest single product that you've ever had to write for? Just something coming across your desk and you saying like, well, this is going to be an all-day project.
Hardest one to write about was about concrete compaction equipment. I can't even remember what the exact tool was, but I was just getting deep in the weeds in my research. Like, I was very curious about it, but I was going down this rabbit hole of research to the point where I just landed on like a university research paper on like fluid dynamics to like get medium slump concrete level or something like that. And I was like, how did I get here? This is taking way too long. But there was just not a lot of information about what the product did. And so I was just researching and researching until finally I was like, okay, I think I can describe like what this product actually does and what the useful information is about it. But to be honest, like, I had no idea what the most important information about this was. It's like, well, so that was the hardest, was a concrete compactor.
I couldn't even imagine. I know nothing about concrete, so I would have to start from the bare minimum there. One other question just about the field in general. How often do these product descriptions need to be refreshed? Is it only updated when maybe there's an update to the product itself or a newer version, let's say? Or is maintenance a little bit more strict where you're having to go back and, you know, maybe every 3 to 6 months refresh a product because the vernacular has changed or because something has changed surrounding the universe of the product itself?
So that's a good question. We're still trying to figure out the best process for that. Right now, because we're still kind of just getting basic text kind of on the pages as fast as we can, I would say we haven't had to refresh. I've maybe refreshed like 20 products out of the ones I've written, and it's kind of more reactive. I think in the future, we're going to create a more formalized like review or refresh process. Yeah, right now it's still kind of by the seat of our pants, I think. Usually while our products are pretty technical and we try to give specifications that people, that consumers will be shopping for, we try to make them more general, like a range of specifications, so that if something changes with the manufacturer or something like that, it'll still be within that range. So that's kind of how we try to make it a little bit more evergreen. And then the client, on the client side, if there's like, oh, well, we don't offer this product anymore, they have a process on their end to control that.
Now, I want to go a little bit outside of your career for a couple of questions here. And now I know you have a graduate degree in communication. We both do, actually. So I'm always interested to talk to other people in the communication field or that have studied communication there. How did that background in communication, obviously you're doing communicating through words, but how did that background change the way you look at this particular position?
So I went to Pitt State and I mostly focused on health and science communication, as well as I took a lot of PR classes and I was a TA for intro to PR. So it was very strategic communication. So like having a plan in place, doing your research before you start writing. Also, my team is called the performance content team because we write content that has some sort of measurable result. Like I wouldn't describe myself as like a creative copywriter, even though I find myself creative, but we're very focused on like organic search results, conversions, or whatever the business goal for our client. And that's, I definitely took that from my PR classes and my degree, as well as like being able to research and communicate those conclusions or communicate that research for an audience. I definitely learned during my studies. I would say it definitely helped me.
And finally, the cool thing about this particular interview is that we were talking beforehand. I'm not used to not recording the interviewee. You're recording it on your end. And that's because you have a podcast of your own that has nothing to do about what we're talking about here. But I was wondering if you could tell our listeners just a little bit about the podcast that you have there.
Sure. Yeah. First of all, it's very fun for me to take out like all my recording equipment. Like I very much like nerd out on audio stuff. So my podcast is called Fact and Science Fiction. It's about like the science behind common sci-fi themes and tropes. I don't update it as often as you guys update Retail Focus. You guys are like on such an admirable release schedule. I'm very impressed because it's so hard to create a podcast and work a full-time job. But so it's just me, and I just, again, I'm very into research, as we've talked about. So it's very research heavy, but it's also like very much inspired by the kind of sci-fi I like to read and watch. So each episode is a different like sci-fi theme or trope. And then I either have an example of something I've read or watched recently, as well as research into that topic.
So it's cool. We can check it out. We can learn quite a bit. Anything that's research backed is a plus in our book for sure here on the show. So Carly, I just want to thank you for taking the time to join us today, talking a little bit about writing for products in the e-commerce sense. We appreciate having you on. And like I said, we'll look forward to listening to that podcast.
Thank you so much.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
No looking ahead in this segment of the podcast, because as we mentioned to start the podcast, we don't know what's coming next. The country could be shut down by tomorrow morning. Anything could happen. So no real use in looking ahead necessarily, but I did want to close with this. This is something that we've worked quite a bit in the past in terms of stories with the PRSM Association, which is kind of a store maintenance association, if you will. They sent some interesting stuff to us this week regarding retailers closing thousands of stores. Now, typically, according to data provided by PRSM, now known by Connex, The average retailer closed only 17 store locations annually, whether that was temporary or otherwise. Now, in the last month, at least 110 retailers have closed thousands of locations due to the coronavirus or the COVID-19 outbreak. These locations, oftentimes they mention in this data, are referred to as dark stores. But Leighton, there's a lot of things that go into this. And I think it was important to mention because we can talk about stores shutting down, but it's not just, hey, the store shuts down, you turn off the lights and you leave and you come back in a couple of months. It's a lot of things like security, systems management, and all of that that you have to stay on top of when you close those stores. And I think it's important for people to know that. And not only do you have those systems like HVAC, for example, water and electric, but also there's exterior maintenance. You've got landscaping because goodness knows they're not going to stop enforcing city codes during this time. Ongoing site assessment as well. So it's very interesting. There's a store shutdown checklist that they created, that Connex created. And I found this kind of interesting because you think about this type of thing and you think again, like, oh, hey, you just shut down everything. But you have to look at things like janitorial resources, like making sure those machines are maintained. Also, if you're a grocery retailer or if you have any type of refrigeration and you're forced to shut down, of course, those have to be maintained as well. So that's a worry not only for grocers, not only for retailers, general merchandise retailers, but also for restaurants. So just a few things to keep in mind as we say so long for this week. And I'm sure you will hear more about that during the earnings calls of some of these retailers that have either elected to shut down or have been shut down by their respective state governments. Well, that'll do it for today. Once again, for Leighton, I'm Trent. Thanks to Carly Kaler as well for joining us on the show as our interview guest. And we'll be back, hopefully everything willing, as long as there's still internet connections and the ability to record a podcast 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.